In our first episode of the year, we take a trip to the United Kingdom, where Jonathan Chippendale leverages tech and data to shape consumer perceptions and adoptions of our favorite fashion brands. With a fascinating childhood rooted in adventure and curiosity, Jonathan turned a fascination with style and culture into a valuable asset in the world of business. And that has helped brands like Louis Vuitton, Richemont, and Tommy Hilfiger to win the hearts and minds of an entire generation of consumers. So, in this episode, we discuss key lessons that he has learned from working closely with creative directors such as Virgil Abloh, incredible events such as the New York Fashion Week, and insights from his conversations with fellow colleagues in the industry. Join us for a mind-blowing exploration of consumer psychology and a radical approach to innovation in digital retail. Guys, it's a new year and we are definitely kicking it off with a bang.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Wherever it is that you're joining us in from, welcome back to the Boardroom Banter podcast and happy, happy new year. For those who are joining us for the first time, this is the first episode of the year. My name is Boniface Baraza Omina, also known as the local noisemaker, international MC, voice of the party, if you know me from the Paradise Island of Mauritius, and your host for today. Last time that we were on the podcast with you guys, we had a phenomenal conversation with a guest in the investment industry. Right around that time, we had just hit our two-year anniversary on the podcast. So shout out to the team and to the incredible audience that we have across the continent and across the world for your continued support. The journey has been long, but it has been very fulfilling with the different conversations that we've had on the podcast and more so the different stories of different industry leaders and global leaders that we've had the chance to highlight here on the podcast. That said, we also want to give an amazing shout out to our Boardroom community. The Boardroom community is our podcast community, which features some of our audience members and community of young people from around the continent and the world as well. So shout out to every single one of you for the amazing work that we've been doing on that end. Without further ado, this is yet another beautiful opportunity for us to get to hear from an industry expert. As mentioned, we were in the investment industry last time, talking about specifically the African context. And today we're here to take a deep dive into the fashion industry, fashion retail, and hear from a seasoned expert who is with me in studio right now. Today's guest is the co-founder of Holition. Holition is an award-winning creative innovation studio based in London. A lot of the work that they do and that the founder does, you know, she is shaping the way, you know, some of the world's luxury brands use and think about technology. And we'll hear from the founder himself of the incredible work that he does. And, you know, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Jonathan Chippendale. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, thank you, everybody. Lovely to be here. Thanks a lot for asking me. That's quite an introduction, Bonnie. So I'll just say hi. And yes, I'm indeed Jonathan. I'm very much looking forward to having a chat with you.
Hi, Jonathan. For those who didn't hear where you're joining us from before we hopped in, could you tell us a bit about where you're calling in from?
No problem at all. I am a born and bred Londoner. I was born here. I was educated here. When I came back from university, I got my first jobs here. And so continuing that legacy of living in and working in the middle of London, I'm speaking to you from Holition, which is based right in the kind of epicenter of London, not that far from Covent Garden. So two or three stops up the central line into the thriving retail heart of London, Bond Street and Oxford Street. Anyone that's listening to this and is interested in the work that we do, there's an open invitation to come and pop in and have a cup of tea and a biscuit with us at any time.
Sweet. There you have it, guys. If you're listening in from London, please hop in for a coffee with Jonathan.
Wherever you are. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the kind of work that we do is probably 90% of our work is delivered overseas. You know, the luxury, the fashion and the beauty industry mm-hmm. are huge, enormous industries, but they're actually run by a relatively small number of brands and players. So a lot of the work that we do, it might be commissioned in the UK, it might be commissioned overseas, but often it means that we're jumping onto planes and deploying work in a range of markets around the world. So yeah, we're very happy to see our neighbours from London, but we're also very happy to see anybody just to come in. Most of the projects that we've done have started from conversations on this very sofa.
Yeah. That's a beautiful, beautiful start, Jonathan. And on that very note, if you were to explain to perhaps a 10-year-old in brief on the work that you do, how would you phrase it to a 10-year-old in the simplest way?
Well, what's great about that is as I get older and my team gets younger, they seem to explain most things to me as if I'm a 10. So that's fine. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction that we're a creative technology studio. I mean, the irony of it is, although I co-founded this about 16 years ago, I'm not totally sure what Halition is, and I'm not totally sure what we are. And the reason for that is that place that Halition operates in, that kind of fashion tech, retail tech space, it's still changing and evolving and modifying regularly, continuously. And it really hasn't, it's a bit like a kind of rock's been thrown into a pond and the ripples haven't evened themselves up and the sort of bottom is still muddy and murky. There's still, no one really understands yet what are the kind of rules and regulations that the sort of do's and don't do's in this kind of fashion tech space. So basically that means that everybody in this area is constantly innovating. So I only really know what we are today and what we might be when the telephone rings and we get the next briefing. But a creative technology studio, that I can recognize that, because a lot of what Halition does is kind of play in that center ground between where science meets art, that kind of cultural space in the middle. Some people have referred to us as a practice-based consultancy. And I think what they mean by that is a lot of what we do is think about the future direction of technology, particularly within relevance to the fashion and luxury world, perhaps over 15, 20, 30 years time. And then the work that we do are little steps of exploration and understanding to help validate that direction, or perhaps to divert that direction into somewhere that feels a little bit more fruitful. When we first met, you were talking about we had been called what would happen if Willy Wonka built technology, and that was something that came out of an article that the Financial Times wrote, and I think they wrote that because a lot of the work that we do is more prosaic and commercial, and you know, drive sales of products on websites and things such as that. But there's also, I have no doubt that we'll talk a bit about this later in the podcast, but we also do a lot of work which is kind of more unusual and plays more to the sort of human emotion, the human mind. And it's a bit more cultural and a bit more informative and a bit more insightful. And some of those can be a little bit unusual in terms of projects. And the unusual sort of nature of that project meant that we were sometimes referred to as a Willy Wonka, kind of doing unusual mad things. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But I think I like to think of us as a digital anthropology studio, and myself as a digital anthropologist, because I think, unlike a lot of, I've never sort of drunk the Kool-Aid and just assumed that all technology is cool because it's tech. For me, technology is a tool for us to use. It's not the story. It's a mechanism to amplify a story. And therefore, the way we operate is we'll always start strategically. I'm a marketing director by training, and I'm very interested in brands and differentiation and personality and tone of voice and how one brand positions itself in a different place to another brand, and actually how brands are different rather than how they're similar. And if we can understand that, then we can think creatively about how to amplify that personality. And if we do it that way, we find that the right kinds of technologies self-select themselves. So we're not sort of technology first, we're technology last. And the reality is you can have the world's most high quality, expensive, beautiful television screen, but if you're watching bad content, then your experience is poor. So I think, you know, we create really compelling digital narratives, and we use technology to tell people, to tell audiences about that. But the critical thing is the story, and whether we can deliver a compelling story. And just on the digital anthropology side, that means that we think very much about how people react with technology, how people absorb technology, that kind of human idea of the relationship between humans and technology. And if we can get that bit right through observation, understanding, intuition, then we can craft the story in the right place.
Right.
So I think that's a longhand version of what we do.
Now that sounds really exciting, and I don't think I've ever heard anyone refer to themselves as a digital anthropologist. So I'm very curious to understand where that comes from. If there's something that we figured out pretty early on in the podcast, and I've appreciated it a lot more, is that a lot of the work that we see our guests do, and a lot of, you know, just relating to our experiences here on the podcast, a lot of it is as a result of some of our very deep childhood experiences, or a lot of the exposure and nurturing that we got growing up. And this is something that, you know, we don't just see through where our passions lie, perhaps, or our interests, but also in our mannerisms and, you know, value systems, you know, to a very, very specific extent. And I'd love to understand that aspect of your story, Jonathan, for myself and for the listeners, to understand who you are today and the work that we do. And the work that you do, what do we need to know about your early childhood experiences and some of the environments that you grew in?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, and this is interesting because it's a question that I've not considered for sort of 30 or 40 years. But yeah. I do think one of the things that, I mean, I went to a school right in the very heart of London called Westminster. It's basically part of Westminster Abbey, right over the road from the House of Parliament. And one of the things I think was very interesting about that school is it was a very liberal school. And the headmaster, a guy called John Ray, Dr. John Ray, recognized very early that you can't keep people inside a school in the middle of London. If they want to get out, and if they want to go drinking, or they want to get into trouble, or they want to go and see art or music or whatever it is, you can't put a wall around it and prevent them from getting out. So it was kind of encouraged. Friends of mine that went to schools sort of in the middle of the country, they're in a village and the kids can't get out of, if they get out into the school, they're into a small village, they'll get spotted. But in London, you can lose yourself very, very easily. And I think what was interesting about that was that there was very much an endeavor of, well, I guess it goes back to that insight of the teachers that all of us kind of remember are the teachers that encouraged us to find out for ourselves, rather than tell you what to think. They encourage you to find out. And there's definitely an element of that in our work. Definitely an element of that in our work. I kind of feel, and I'm thinking about politics in the world today, but I kind of feel that everybody's talking. By the way, that's being amplified by social media, right? So everyone's talking and there's not enough listening going on in the world. Everybody's shouting and getting louder and louder and louder. We end up in these kind of polarized worlds. We try and take a much softer view of the work that we do. And we encourage people to find out for themselves. And I'll give, and by the way, we don't mind what insights people get from our work as long as they get an insight and we can have a conversation about it. And I'll give you an example. We did a piece with in collaboration with an amazing lady called Professor Helen Story, who is a professor of sustainable fashion at the London College of Fashion. And the project was to work with UNHCR around refugees, and we built a dress that was made out of a refugee tent, a United Nations refugee tent that came from a refugee camp in
that sounds so
Jordan,
cool,
but with UN markings and with the guy ropes, and it had housed Syrian families and but had been damaged in a storm, and therefore we were able to take it and sort of work the magic in it. And there are, or when we did the project, there were on average 43,500 new refugees registering for asylum every single day. And the dress was connected to UN databanks. And 7 seconds after a refugee registered for asylum in a country, one dot would appear above on the hem of the dress, color-coded to the country. And all of these dots would rise up the dress, and the dress would fill up like a reverse Tetris with, on average, 43,500 knots or stitches or weaves every single day. But each of those stitches was a person looking for a better world. And it was shown in the United Nations. It's been on various tours. But One year, it was in the Science Museum as a centerpiece in London, as a centerpiece of big data, and of an exhibition around big data. And two people from the UK were looking at the dress, and one person was looking at it as evidence of like thousands and thousands of people coming to the UK, and we need barriers and borders and controls and immigration and all of that stuff. That narrative. Someone else was looking at exactly the same data and thinking that we have an obligation to help our fellow citizens. And by the way, I'm not getting into the rights and wrongs of either of those views. It was fascinating to sit back in the background and just listen to two people talking about it. And they were attracted, to take it back to where we started, they were attracted by the sheer beauty or the spectacle of the dress and the information being shown within the weave. Once they got to the dress, to see what it was, their brain started to work out what it was. They got the insights themselves. They took a sort of picture of a narrative, and then they spontaneously started to talk to each other as strangers. And I think that's good. So I think that goes back to that thing of my childhood of like, I don't like to, I the older I get, the worse I get. I don't like to be told what to think. And I don't like people telling me what to think. I'm very open to everybody's point of views, but I'm an accommodationist, right? You can think whatever you want to think. That is your right. Please don't tell me what I must think. And you know that goes down to what wine I drink, but it also goes down to politics and everything that kind of drives the way I do and aspire to live my life. And it's something that I tell my children. You know, they may be young. They may be old, but their point of view is every bit as relevant as anyone else on this world, and they stick to it.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing about sort of mentioned of not the older you get, the more you don't like people telling you what to think. I'm in a certain season of my life, right? You know, we finished college in November with Yuri at the African Leadership University. We graduate this month, actually. Today is the 1st of February. Yeah,
amazing.
We graduate. Thank you.
Such a cool thing to do. No, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yale has this really interesting graduation where they have the GCU faculty and people come. So it's a GCU/ALU graduation. But yeah, so it's this season of life where a lot of people are either asking you what to do, what you want to do, or trying to you know, suggest different approaches to this season of, you know, finishing college and transitioning to the workspace and so on and so forth. And a lot of the feelings that come with that is, you know, this rebelliousness, especially like with our background in entrepreneurship, there is a lot of work and projects that we've been investing our time in. And there is, you know, there are expectations to carry that forward. But then you find that there's a lot of voices around me in this specific season of my life and just trying to filter out and see which is the best approach, you know, not perfect, but the best approach that will, you know, guarantee me whichever outcome I want in this next season of my life. And I'd be very curious to understand your post-college transition, right? When you were moving into the workspace, were there any pivotal moments or realizations or people or voices that directed you towards your initial career path? And how did you navigate sort of balancing what you're hearing other people or the world saying at the time, as compared to the specific direction that you wanted to go?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I haven't got any great insights because, to be honest, my career has been tumbling down a hill, you know, in a variety of different manners, but gravity is taking me towards the bottom, which has been good, right? I mean, talk about that in a little bit more detail, but just hearing you talk, Bonnie, I do think that, you know, one of the things I think has been that I often talk to the boys and girls that work for me here is that I found very useful for me is to have a really, really, you're talking about a world where you're being presented with lots of opportunities, but those opportunities typically feel quite rational because they're like jobs and roles and positions and locations, and they require skills. And it's on that sort of more sort of quantitative side. I kind of say to the boys and girls here that like sit down and really look into yourself and really, really identify like the muscles in your brain that you enjoy doing. Not the jobs, not the roles, definitely not the salaries, just the muscles in your brain that you enjoy working with and be really and utterly brutal about it and rank them. Like, what is the number one of those? What is the number two? And then every opportunity that presents itself, judge it against those kind of preferences and again, be really, really brutal. And I guess what I think is interesting about doing that, well, for my own self, so I had a career in luxury for many, many years, you know, 20 or 30 years. And as I got more senior in the luxury world, what was happening quietly, secretly, not secretly, but by stealth, was that I was becoming a manager, not a marketer. I was managing other people who were doing marketing, where actually what I joined to do, what I got sort of hit from was marketing, being, you know. And so when I conducted that exercise on myself, what I realized is that it was really important for me to think strategically. I really enjoyed the intellectual conundrum of being a strategic marketing director, and that was really, really important to me. But equally important was being creative, thinking up ideas, being spontaneous, which goes against the intellectual side in many ways, because the intellectual side is, let's think really, really carefully before we place our left foot down. Let's look at the ground, let's assess everything. We'll now put our foot down, right? Where do we stick our next foot? And bit by bit by bit, luxury brands move forward, all brands move forward. The creative bit was like, what if we take a turn? What if we do something else? You know, what if we create something interesting and unusual? How can we test that? I needed both of those. And I very quickly realized that the only way I was going to marry that desire to be strategic and intellectual, but also creative, was to do something myself. And actually, I was of an age where it was time to start my own agency, because thinking about people telling me what to do, when I started Tolition, it was right at the beginning of this digital journey, right at the very big beginning. And digital was, you know, not a thing at all. It was, you know, the iPhone wasn't launched. Twitter wasn't heard of. No one knew what Twitter was. And Facebook had 1.2 million users. So it was right at the beginning of this kind of journey. So I came from an analog world, and the amount of bosses that I had in luxury who would say something like, Jonathan, until you've worked in luxury for 30 years, don't tell me about how to be a luxury marketing director. And that just felt crass and stupid. Of course, now in the digital world, that crassness has been exposed, because actually, what the earth does 30 years in luxury, how does that enable you to talk to a Chinese Gen Z, you know, using TikTok? You know, I mean,
exactly. It's a whole different.
Yeah, that 30 years, which was a strength, overnight has become an anchor around your neck, dragging you down into obsolescence. So that was a big driver for me. So I guess the answer is just think about the things that you want to do rather than the roles that you want to do. And I think what was very useful for me, but it doesn't work for everybody, is it meant that I wasn't automatically going for the jobs that paid more. Because what I realized is that you can get a job that pays more, but if it's not doing what you want to do, then the first time you get your pay packet, you'll be exultant. But then every month, you'll think, oh God, I've got to get out of bed, and I don't want to do something I don't want to do. Whereas the opposite is, I could do with a bit more money, but I love what I do, and I can't wait to get into the office and work with cool people and do things that really motivate me. So those are the kind of things that I would think about. So those are the kind of things that I used to think about.
Yeah, that's really solid, Jonathan. And as you were speaking about asking oneself and reflecting on such a question, I thought back to our first year at ALU with Yuri, right? And that was, you know, we got into ALU after two gap years out of high school. We'd done a couple of entrepreneurial projects at the time, you know, just getting a feel of it and dabbling in, you know, in this passion area that we just discovered. By the time we got into ALU, we spent that first year building an events brand on the island. So we're building it as foreigners, focusing on more continental African music. I'm trying to penetrate this local scene in Mauritius. And it was a bit, you know, it had its challenges, had its highs and lows. The lows were really low. I remember when I came back to Kenya the next year for summer, I had wanted to understand the events industry. And my reasoning, I was studying business management. My reasoning was, to understand a certain industry, it's important to look at it grassroots. So bottom up, right? Look at what are the what are the people in the industry, the players in the industry doing grassroots, and how does it look high level? And around that time, one of the interesting things that I managed to come across was the intersection within the events industry, right? The intersection between, rather, correction, within the creative industry in Kenya, the intersection between music and fashion. And it was when I went for a pop-up event that was being run by a streetwear brand here in Kenya. And it was being sponsored by Jägermeister, an alcohol brand. And there were DJs, there were performances. And seeing this mix got me to understand, you know, some of the trends that were shaping the fashion industry and by default to the creative industry in general. And, you know, I'd love now to come to your 20 plus years experience in the luxury industry, fashion retail generally. You know, for someone who is not really aware or informed on the current trends within the industry, what trends do you currently see shaping the landscape? And if you were to look back over your years in the industry, how has the industry evolved over the course of this period of time?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to talk about that a lot from a digital point of view, which is the kind of
perfect bit, yeah,
that we do. But just before we do that, and on the same topic, I mean, when you talk about that fusion of fashion and music, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest trends that's certainly not overtaken, but has changed the luxury space. I mean, and actually, ironically, it was Louis Vuitton on both occasions that have done it, by hiring creative directors that have come from a very strong streetwear space.
Exactly.
I mean, when I think about, you know, we did a bit of work with Louis Vuitton, Virgil Abloh, and, you know, talking to him was outstanding because for, you know, 30 or 40 years, luxury had been defined by the color black, the color white, the color beige or tan, and a bit of Burberry check here and there. And those have been the kind of primary colors of fashion. And suddenly Virgil Abloh came onto the scene with every single color under the rainbow, an explosion of color, and sneakers and streetwear and music and art and everything all at once everywhere. It was you know, the kind of energy that he brought, and that juxtaposition between a kind of old school Ancien Régime French luxury brand and this kind of noise that was visual and sonic that was coming from Virgil Abloh was electrifying and immediately made Louis Vuitton relevant and cool. And now, sadly that Virgil Abloh passed away, but they've now taken Pharrell Williams, and we went to the fashion, they put a fashion show on Pont Neuf on one of the bridges that go across the Seine. And, you know, it was one of like two fashion shows that I've been to where I was actually smiling the whole time, right? Because normally they're all quite serious, everyone's trying to be cool, yeah, I'm having a look at the fashion, but you know, there was so much positive energy that Pharrell Williams brought to that show that, again, I think that idea of you know, for me, ideas are, yeah, I'm fortunate in that I've worked with one or two people throughout the course, worked for or with or met one or two people who you can absolutely say are geniuses. You know, we sort of met and did something with Elon Musk once, Alexander McQueen. The tragedy with Lee McQueen is that he didn't realize that he was a genius, and the sort of confidence demons got to him. But my gosh, what an amazing man, and a few others. But most of us mere mortals are not geniuses, and actually, you know, we kind of get creative by that age-old principle of two people coming together and between them having a third idea that they wouldn't have had individually, by building on other people's ideas and taking ideas forward. And, you know, that's kind of where a lot of creativity comes from. But what Louis Vuitton did was actually get, you know, some proper geniuses in to shock people, not shock them in a bad way, but to grab their attention and focus it in a completely different direction. And that's such a difficult thing to do. Going back to the question in terms of some of the sort of trends, well, I mean, one of the things I think is, you know, people often ask me, like, what is the impact of digital, you know, in the retail industries and the fashion industries? And, you know, people talk about social media, they talk about e-commerce, they talk about AR or metaverse or whatever it is, and we can talk about all of those. No problem at all. They're all spaces in which we operate in. But I think the biggest impact has been not so much about the technologies, but about control. Because when I, in the analog world, the pre-digital world, when I was a marketing director, we used to create these brands that were kind of rigid structures. They were quite intimidating. They were the sort of playthings of the rich and the VIPs and the supermodels. So the kind of brand world, which none of us could really be part of, but we all aspired to kind of join. And so we would go into these really intimidating stores with security on the front to kind of buy a bit of Gucci. And Gucci had made a career out of telling, or a business out of telling women and men what to wear, how to wear it, and when to wear it before they knew it themselves. It was all talking at customers. And what digital's done is it's kind of meant that brands can't just talk at or to people. They've got to have conversations with people, because Gucci might say that its new range is, the best thing ever. But if the background noise on social media or influencers or reviews says otherwise, well, the reality is that Gucci is just one voice alongside every other voice. And that process of having to cede control, give up some control to to consumers, has really been the kind of overriding drive that digital has kind of created or kind of leveraged. And the brands that are more successful are the ones that recognize that sooner and started to do that much earlier. And the ones that feel old-fashioned and kind of stilted now are the ones that are still kind of tweeting and using digital channels, but as a way of talking down to people. And I think, when you think about one of the things I find really interesting about that, and maybe this goes back to digital anthropology, but I think it's quite interesting how the brands that are doing this well are starting to feel very comfortable about being sort of polymorphic or about having multiple personalities. I mean, we do work with Burberry, and when you I remember having lunch a few years ago with Burberry's social media director. And she was saying that what they do is they create a massive range of fundamentally different types of material content. And some of it could be really sexy and edgy and involving a kind of French DJ and doing something a bit underground. And then something could be more about the history and the heritage. Something could be about its views on sustainability. Something could be about the fashion. Something could be about Cary Grant or other 1940s and 50s actors wearing that product. And you kind of metaphorically lay it all out on the table. And then interestingly, different people pick up different bits of it. So, my daughter might pick up the edgier, more contemporary bits and share those. And my mother might do the opposite and go to the old stuff. And it's the same brand, right? But different people are now taking the bits that they feel mirror their own view of the brand. And what you end up with is a brand that's nebulous and amorphic and multifaceted. It's different things to different people. And I really like that idea because, I don't know about you, Bonnie, but the reality is that I'm a different person at different times of different days. Sometimes I'm
Very
happy,
true.
sometimes I'm down, sometimes I'm up for it, sometimes I just want to chill. And brands are starting, the ones that are doing it well are the ones that are recognizing that there is no need to be rigid. And in fact, there's no benefit in rigidity. We're not just about a logo or a product in a store, but we've actually got a personality. It's kind of making them more human. And then when you think about
More human,
like,
yes. So back to what you said earlier, the human part, yeah.
exactly. And I think if you think about Gucci, again, talking about Gucci and what they do now, they don't go all in on one or two big ideas. They're constantly trying lots of little things. So a bit of the metaverse, a little bit of Roblox, bit of AR, bit of this, bit of sponsoring of esports, bit of virtual fashion, just lots of kind of stuff. And that feels, again, very human. Like, we'll try a bit of this, we'll try a bit of that, we'll pop into that store, we'll drink a different beer. We don't all go on holidays to the same place every year. We
Right.
don't always shop at the same shops every single year. We don't do the same things. By nature, there are these four sort of core human needs. We all need to play, we all need
Yeah.
to connect, we all need to acquire, but we all need to explore. And I think that kind of idea, digital provides a very wide smorgasbord of different types of tools that allow humans to explore, but also the brands to explore as well.
New year, new me. Sounds familiar? Well, one of our goals as podcast hosts has been to get deeper into our bags. And a key part of that is learning about diversifying our income and investments. This episode is sponsored by Apex, a cryptocurrency exchange that understands the importance and increasing complexity of investing in the 21st century. And they make it easier and simple to make your first step. Explore the world of opportunities with Apex today.
I'm learning a lot about what I don't see beyond, you know, just what as a consumer is marketed to me, right? And it's the back end innovation, it's the thinking, the human centered design behind a lot of these products. And I can only imagine how balancing these ideas in the boardrooms could look like, right? Because you have people who are looking at how the industry is changing and where it's going and where it's headed, and they're saying, right, we need to do this differently. We need to introduce this. And then you have the people in these organizations who have been there for years, and they're looking at the traditions and the culture that was already established before the disruption. So it's a disruption or no disruption, which is a lot of what happens when it comes to this technology. And, you know, when you mention control, whether it's AI or otherwise, how do we balance all of these different things that we think we should do, right? Which begs the question.
I can give you a good example of that. Back in 2022, in September at New York Fashion Week, we were the lead creative agency that delivered Tommy Hilfiger's fashion show. Oh. And there were a couple of interesting sides to that. So one is, there was a fashion show in New York. The overall theme was around Andy Warhol, and Andy Warhol is synonymous with New York, so it had to be in New York. We found a space on Brooklyn overlooking Manhattan, and we put the physical show there. But Tommy Hilfiger had been exploring for a few months the sort of 3D world, the metaverse world. So what the idea was to have the physical show and create a simultaneous Roblox platform of the show and have the two sitting side by side together, so that the way the models walked and behaved in the real show was mirrored in the digital world simultaneously. And the way that all of the players were playing in the digital world changed the physical show in real time. So the two felt kind of quite hybrid. And that was all the kind of aim, and that's what we delivered. And there were a couple of interesting bits that came out of it. The first one is perhaps more obvious, and the second ones are a little bit more interesting. But the first one was a lot of people within the organization trying to get their brains around whether the Roblox world were actually the right audience. Were they too young? Were they actually potentially Tommy Hilfiger customers? Are we spending all of this money talking to people who aren't actually Tommy Hilfiger customers? And that's a fair enough question, right? Except,
very fair.
Yeah, because Roblox is definitely skewed towards a kind of younger teen audience. But, you know, so in that world, something like 30 million people have now played it. Yeah, and even if, you know, 1 or 2% of that audience are your core audience, the numbers still mean it's by far and away the most widespread, effective way of communicating. Full stop, right? It's much better than TV. It's much better than magazines and outdoor print. So there's still a value there. But that was an interesting conversation. But the second one was actually really interesting. So what we did is we had these in the Roblox space now. We created these 60-foot models, each wearing the actual item of clothing, and they walked across a Roblox Brooklyn bridge and fanned out around Manhattan. And we thought, we'll create these really beautiful models. The Roblox community wanted the little blocky Roblox Lego-y type things, so we did those. But we also created a number of other kind of characters, so people could play as rabbits, people could play as people with green skin, you know, a really sort of mixed range of characters that people could play in. And Tommy Hilfiger looked at that and went, wow, that's great. So in fact, in the Roblox world, you can have an incredibly diverse range of people. And they took that into the fashion show. So the fashion show was unbelievably diverse. There were people of different ethnicities, people of different heights, people with disabilities, people with red hair, blonde hair, just everything, kids, old people, an 80-year-old. They really kind of embraced the diversity, and a lot of that was driven by roadblocks. And just finally, as I mentioned, these two worlds were meant to work simultaneously. And the reality is the fashion show, they had Kim Kardashian and Travis Barker played drums, and Shawn Mendes were there with Kate Moss,
They went
and
all
they
out,
all,
didn't they?
and by the way, Jonathan Chippendale was in there somewhere, and they were all, I mean, what the hell was he doing there? But they wouldn't, I mean, they wouldn't sit down. Shawn Mendes was doing a TV interview and wouldn't sit down. And, Mrs. Kardashian, the mum, was talking to one of her daughters and, some musician, and they wouldn't sit down. And finally, we had to get everybody sat down, and the show ran 20, about 20 minutes. It started about 20 minutes late. Meanwhile, in the Roblox world, everybody was waiting for the show to start, a million people. And because it was late, lots of them just thought, I'm off, I'm off,
So
I'm not doing it.
that was the
So the numbers
disconnect.
went down. I mean, there was still a lot of people, but a good third of the people left because the show hadn't started. And suddenly Tommy Hilfiger as a brand realized that actually, rather than being a bunch of kids or teenagers, actually they had to respect those people better than they had. Actually, if you're going to invite someone to your house for a show, you need to make sure that show starts online on time. Sorry. And actually, they suddenly realized that this audience wasn't just a kind of bit of PR, but actually they had to treat them with exactly the same respect as they would every other VIP. And I thought that was really interesting.
Wow. It takes me back to the different events that we've hosted over the years, and meeting people where they're at when it comes to promising a service and delivering a service.
Yeah, it's quite
And I
basic,
think,
right?
yeah, it's quite, is it though?
Well, I mean, it should be, right? Because we
It
all
should
expect,
be, yeah.
we don't expect rudeness, we don't expect aloofness, we don't expect people to ignore us. And that was basically what was happening. I mean, that's not what Tommy Hilfiger intended. It wasn't what they meant, and actually it wasn't what they actually did. But that's that basic level of respect to people that you invite into. It exists online just as much as it exists face to face.
One of the things that comes to mind from what you said, when you explain the different people that came together to, to put the event together, and not just that, but the different communities where the audience came from. It makes you think about like the value of community, because
Yeah.
I love to compare, your experience in luxury with what I see when it comes to some of the local brands here in the country. My cousin runs a fashion brand. It's called At Odds. It's about 3 or 4 years old, and what I've realized happens when it comes to some. I see it in the music community. I see it in the fashion community here in the country. They end up organizing themselves into different collectives, right? And creative hubs. So, for instance, my cousin is based at MB, a place called MB Creative. Aside from him being having his container with his fashion brand on this side, you find the next stall, their artists, painters on the next. In the next room, there are photographers and so on and so forth, and other fashion brands. And there's a very interesting cross collaboration that happens. And you have like artist studios as well, like music creators. An interesting cross collaboration that you see is, for example, if one of these music artists has a show, they double down and collaborate with the different fashion designers to put together their outfits. And they get recognition for that. You find that the photographer on the other corner is the one who's going to do the photography for the event, the videographer from that end is going to come together. And so you find that the fashion industry is being, the success of a fashion brand or of this music brand is being supported by all of these other entities, and sort of through systems thinking and how that collaboration comes about in the different contexts, whether it's a fashion event, whether it's a music event. It all comes together for the greater good and greater value and benefits to everyone. Now, I'd love to hear your thoughts on sort of this specific scenario of
the different elements of the community coming together. And if you can speak to sort of what it takes to keep these communities together, the glue that holds them together, if it's not the reason why they're there at that specific time, the ethos of the event or the reason why they're convening, are there some of these trends or observations that you've made in your line of work with regards to this overall community adding value to each other?
So on the community, so I'm not sure I can talk to the community, but I can absolutely say that one of the things that I think is, and it goes back to the impact of digital on brands, on the fashion world. I mean, I think one of the directions of travel, which is unmistakable, and it's a direction of travel that we amplify every possible opportunity, is that notion of spontaneity. Again, it's that idea of brands having to cede control. And one of the impacts of that ceding of control is to increase spontaneity. And a lot of our projects, so when we did the Tommy Hilfiger fashion show, one of the ways that we spoke to Tommy was that idea of, wouldn't it be incredible if we create some boundaries, but no one has any idea what's going to happen, right? And so even you, Tommy, you will create those boundaries, but then you'll just be another spectator and seeing what happens. And it's something that, it's a kind of technique that we call board gaming inside Helition. And it's that idea that we can create a game together, Bonnie, and let's call it, I don't know, Monopoly, for example. And that game's got rules, but every time we play it, we get different outcomes. We do quite a lot of work in this space where we'll create rules, like in the fashion space and some of the projects that we do, but then no one's really got any idea what the outcome is. And actually viewing and understanding the outcome is actually one of those kind of insights that are, you know, part of the kind of project, that notion of learning. And I think kind of goes back to some of the sort of Willy Wonka stuff that we were talking about, because, you know, one of the things I do think about, like the really powerful bits of technology, like the technology is full stop, not just in fashion, full stop, that are really, really powerful. That there's this kind of idea of technology entropy that sort of kicks in for us, which is they're so powerful that they kind of disappear. They kind of weave themselves into the fabric of our lives and therefore don't really stand out. The stuff that stands out is the clunky tech that doesn't fit into our lives. And like, you know, the iPhone or mobile phones, you know, I don't think about them anymore. It's what I look at when I wake up. It's what I look at when I go to sleep. It's, you know, but it's the windows through which I learn about the world. I look at the news. I look at, you know, and I'm not saying that it's all good, right? I'm absolutely understanding the algorithms that create echo chambers and filter fake news into me. I understand it, but it's still the primary source that I use to understand the world around me. So even though it's just in front of my face, it's a teleporting device going out around the world and around the universe and pulling stories in that I like. But it's also emotional. I mean, I look at the emotional well-being of my family and my friends by looking at what they're posting on social media, and they do the same for me. It isn't just the rational side. You know, people use it to find love on Tinder. They use it to find holiday destinations for recommendations. It's everything that we need. It's kind of coming through that phone, and it sort of disappears. And I think what's so powerful about that is it's the same item that we all carry, just with very sort of highly personalized apps that fit in with our kind of lifestyle. So that notion of kind of not forcing people down routes, but giving them tools to explore, I think that's a really, really interesting area. And again, it goes back to what we talked about right at the beginning, which is that idea of not talking at people, but encouraging them to kind of learn and understand for themselves. And, you know, for example, just kind of that project that's over my shoulder there, that was a piece of fashion that was commissioned by the British Fashion Council at London Fashion Week a few years ago. And they wanted to talk about mental health. And it was a year when poor Kate Spade took her own life. There was conversations around model and abuse and stress levels. And also we wanted to talk about that slightly dystopian space where kind of in social media, where kind of perceptions of beauty and, you know, perfection online kind of clash to the kind of reality of how we are as human beings, and whether that leads to feelings of low self-esteem and things such as that. So So the dress that you see there, it scans the mind of the wearer in real time and uses that data to understand their mood and emotion, and then completely changes colors and patterns according to how you're feeling at that time. So you're kind of literally wearing your heart on your sleeve. And we did it for a number of reasons. One is, yes, it was commissioned. Secondly, a very good friend of the studio had had a stroke and was paralyzed from the neck down and couldn't speak. And we wanted to see whether we could repurpose fashion to give a voice back to people that weren't able to communicate. But we also wanted to talk about privacy. Lots of people wore the item and felt deeply uncomfortable sharing the world how they feel, but 2 hours earlier had been posting on Facebook that they're having a miserable day. And that idea that we can be very open and actually quite emotional to complete strangers using digital channels in a way that we couldn't go up to a stranger in real life and pour our hearts out to them. And again, what does that mean for us? And what has digital done to us that it allows an element of anonymity, and that anonymity allows us to express ourselves in kind of more emotional ways. So those kind of things, those kind of unpredictable outcomes, I find very interesting. And maybe it's because I come from an analog luxury world where every single aspect of a brand was tightly controlled. I mean, there's a brand that we do work with that I don't name. They'll kind of kill me. But when you walk into their offices, they every desk is the same. I mean, they're one of the best known brands in the world. And you are allowed to have one photograph of a family or friend, but the photograph has to be vetted by an office committee. And then it comes back to you in one of the brand's official frames, and you can either hang it in the same place on the wall of your cubicle or on a particular place in the desk. You know, that kind of level of control feels Orwellian, to be frank. Bizarre and odd and unusual in a world where on your mobile phone, you can get anywhere you want in a heartbeat.
If you were to hypothesize what reason they could have for such a controlled environment, what would you,
Well, I think, well, I
what does it
think the,
achieve?
well, I really, I mean, the kind of creative director of that particular brand at that time was kind of, when I say old school, that doesn't mean that they were old or well, or but they were a creative director that was known for attention to detail and known for a view of, you know, I know what women want to wear, and so that idea of I has then naturally transferred from the catwalk to every aspect of that
Every
person's
aspect,
life, including all of the, I mean, it was, I mean, going into the, you'd kind of go for a meeting and you'd sign in. One of the things I find very interesting about my job, I find it fascinating, is, again, it goes back to anthropology. I love, I'm very lucky. I can dip into other brands' cultures, and you can always get a sense of what a company is going to be like to work with by the way they treat you at the entrance, at the reception area.
That's
And there are
correct.
some brands where
Ooh.
you where they're dismissive, where they're not rude, right? But they're just a bit short, a bit like, right, wait there, sit there, you know, or you know. And then there are other brands which are like absolutely ch you, and it's funny. It's this kind of stuff filters down through an organization to the reception area, and you get a very, very strong sense of what that company is going to be like from the first moments you walk into their reception area.
I agree with you 100%. There's something that I observe when it comes to events, and there's this philosophy that we have as an events brand with Yuri, where it's about the experience, and the experience that this audience member is going to get from your event begins from the moment they register or buy a ticket to the moment they get to the gate, and so on and so forth. And there's an event that I went for in November. I just come back to Kenya, and there's the security at the gate, right? When you're going in through the barriers and so on and so forth. And it felt like we were being policed through and not necessarily welcomed through, right? To be, they're dressed in the bright reflectors, and they're moving people forward in such a non-gen in not a gentle way. And that definitely affects your psyche as someone who's come to an event because of just how you've been received. And that first impression, I could definitely relate to that aspect of things when it comes to a brand, whether it's a big company, but I'm seeing it with small, event companies here in the country as well. So that's very interesting.
So
We've
Bonnie,
just
whoever
hit our
came into Hellish, I'm hoping that they would that you'd the people would greet you with a smile and a welcome
You
and a
better.
cup of tea. And that comes from the very top. That comes from the very top, Bonnie.
A cup of tea. A cup of tea would sell me, Jonathan. We've just hit our time, Jonathan. And we have a very short last segment that we love to do on the podcast. And I'd love to know whether you're in a position to stick with us for another 5 minutes as we run through this.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, Jonathan. So picture this, right? You and I are walking out of Volition, right? Let's assume Volition is my company, right? And we're walking out and I wave goodbye. And on your way to your elevator, do you guys have an elevator? Let's assume you guys have an
We do
elevator,
have, I
right?
mean, we
There we
typically
go.
use the stairs because we're all up for walking and proper exercise and bit of hard work. We don't use elevators here, but there is one.
All right, let's assume we're going down the stairs and an intern stops you on the way down and has a couple of questions to ask you as you come down. Think of it like an elevator pitch sort of scenario. Let me know if you're ready for my intern's questions.
Yeah, go for it.
Right, sweet. So the first question, if you could change one thing about the way you were raised, what would it be?
Ask about the way I was raised. That is a
This internet isn't playing.
I don't think I would change. So I wouldn't change anything about the way I was raised. I mean, and the reason for that is, I'm sort of midway through my life. I'm quite happy with what I've done, with the choices I've made. It's not always been easy, right? But there's something, but I found a way through. I navigated a way through. I never had a. There's a couple of things here. One is I've never mind when I've come to a fork in a road, I've never minded whether it's left or right. I don't
Oh.
mind. I've never obsessed with it. I've gone with what my heart says, and I've made the very best that I could of that particular journey. And really importantly, I've never looked back over my shoulder and regretted anything.
Ooh.
I have. I mean, there are a couple of relationships I regret, but in terms of professional choices and. And that's and I think that's one thing I would pass on to that intern. Always look forward. Like, what's next? In fact, if you ever watched The West Wing, which is that great American TV series about life in the White House, the president's Martin Sheen's character,
Yeah.
President Barton, his catchphrase is "What's next? Move on. What's next? You're not going to change the
Sweet.
world by worrying about what's happened, but what you're going to do next."
Love it. Love it, Jonathan. Next question. What is one thing that you do not compromise on when it comes to your work?
So one of the things, so one of the sort of energy bonds that kind of holds Volition together, it's the team here is they don't do it for me, they do it for themselves. And no member of this team would ever let each other down. And I think that's really, really important to me. So that's not massively answering your kind of question, but we've managed to create an environment here where the kids here do amazing things for each other. And yes, for me, I'm not saying that it's not for me, but I never really wanted to work in a place that, and by the way, I used to work for companies like this, where you're just trying to get through the day. And if you can get away with something or put something off to the next day, do it. That never happens here. I've got an amazing group of people that work for me that would never walk in. There aren't people here who say, "Look, I mean, I'd love to do that for you tonight, but I've got other things I want to do tonight."
Yeah.
No. I mean, there are times when this studio will work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they do it because they're absolutely passionate about the job that they do. One of the things I think is really amazing about this place is we don't use headhunters. People find us. We don't look for them. They find us.
Oh.
And when they find, and like, about 2 or 3 years ago, this is not untypical or atypical. We were doing some work in Asia, and so I was starting in the office at about 6 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning. And I got into the office, and there was a girl at one of the tables working, and I kind of assumed that she was an intern or whatever. So I didn't think anything more about it. And round about mid-morning, someone came up to me and went, "Do you know who that is?" And I went, "No, I've no idea who that is. I thought you knew." And it turned out that no one knew who she was. And I went off and I had a chat to her. And she had heard me speak at a conference the previous day, had said to her friends, I'm going to work at that agency. That's what I want to do. She had turned up early, had a chat to security, said, oh, I work for Halition. I've lost my key. Could you let me in? He let her in. And she said, look, and I'm not leaving until you give me a job. And I said, I can't pay you. I haven't got the. And she said, fine, I'm going to work as an intern and I'm going to prove myself. And at some point, you will realize that you can't do without me and you'll give me a job. And that's what happened. And a lot of that goes on. So trying to foster that kind of that's been one of the biggest successes. And whenever I stop this, whenever that is, not for a while, I'm not going to think about the work. I'm not going to think about the projects or the brands. I'm going to think about the people here that I've worked with. I'm very, 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 very wow. proud of them.
Jonathan, you know, the Netflix documentaries that are made for interns like that, you know, walked into a company yeah. and just started working there.
Yeah. There's another girl that was studying politics in Glasgow. She's a Lithuanian
wow.
and she wasn't enjoying it. Wasn't GCU, it was the University of Glasgow. And she just one morning just thought, I don't want to work here. She'd been following, I don't want to study politics anymore in Scotland. And she was she just got on a plane, she was following us. She got on a plane from Glasgow, came down to London and knocked on our door and said, I want to work for you. And I said no, because I wasn't prepared for her to give up her degree. But I said, you go back to Scotland, every holiday you can work for us as a freelancer. And if you graduate, there's a job for you. And she's just the other side of that door.
Wow. No, Jonathan, I think just listening to you speak and just spending this time that we have on the podcast, I can see why people are attracted to your organization. And the culture that you've cultivated is not, it's not one that's built on, doesn't seem like one that's built on the compensation, the, you know, material returns that people get from the work. It seems that people are very fulfilled and are loyal because they come to work to with a certain purpose, you know, behind your organization. And from the projects that you've just described, such as the one right behind you, there's a very large aspect of social impact that I see you guys are creating through the work that you do, digital first and in fashion. And I think if I outside looking in, that looks like a very, very big big asset to the work that you do. And so cheers and congratulations to that, Jonathan.
Thank you.
My final question is, if you were to have a billboard in the busiest street in London, say Piccadilly Circus or Leicester Square, you know, whichever kind of street, and you could write a message on this billboard that would metaphorically speak to millions of people every single day, what message would be on your billboard?
Oh, well, that would be easy because we spoke about it earlier, but that idea of listen more. I just think people need to listen. I was listening yesterday to some of the things that were going on in the Senate, the technology leaders being grilled by the House of Representatives, and just kind of just remembering about how things like social media, but also the politics and the religions of this world, are just talking, 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 and no one's listening. And I just, yeah, the thing about listening is like listening equals experience. That's what experience is. That's what knowledge is. Right, knowledge isn't talking to people. Knowledge is acquired over many, many years by conversations with lots of people. And the more information you get, the more information you onboard and take in, the more, the bigger, the greater the ability you have to try and navigate between what's right and wrong. You don't have to agree with everything you hear, but at least don't shout it out. At least listen to it. Listen to it and disagree with it. Don't not listening to it. So I guess I. The older I get, the more sort of, and particularly bear in mind that, you know, by education, I'm a historian, you know, and the mistakes of our past are constantly ignored again and again and again in the future. I just worry, you know, it is one of those kind of sitting by the fire, you know, late at night worrying that actually we're not listening enough. So I would urge, you know, the humans of the world to listen more. And not just talk.
Good thing you're saying that on a podcast, which people are listening to at the moment. So. But yeah, Jonathan,
have
this
fun.
Is
yeah. Have fun while you're listening.
While you're at it, and you seem to be having quite a lot of fun in your area of work. And yeah, you do not look like you're stopping anytime soon. And we're
We're super glad to have had the chance to take a deep dive and a peek into your life and your life story, Jonathan. For our
It's been
listeners,
a
if
pleasure.
you've for our listeners, if you've hung around till now, you are superstars. You are the people. We want more of you people, right? Who reach the end. But if you resonate with any part of Jonathan's story and you can identify with aspects of it, that's amazing. That's phenomenal. If you cannot and you've learned something new through Jonathan's story, then take it a step further. Go on LinkedIn, search up Jonathan, search up Volition, on your Google, check out the amazing work that they're doing. Jonathan, you could probably point people more specifically to where they can find more information about your work. I can give you the floor for that. If people
Yeah, I
want to
mean, look,
connect with
first of
you,
all,
yeah.
check us out on our website is a good place to start. We're completely revamping it in a minute, in a couple of months, and we're revamping our social medias, and the social media will be much more human. It's not very good at the moment, but it's going to be much more human and much more about us. And the website will talk about the work that we do. But again, I urge you, if you're interested, connect on LinkedIn. I always respond to everybody that connects in on LinkedIn, as long as you're not trying to sell me SEO or e-commerce functions. It seems to be quite a lot of the traffic I get at the moment on LinkedIn. If you're interested, again, as I said, most of our best projects start here on a sofa in a conversation. And a client asked me, what categorized a brilliant Hilition project, and I said to her that it's a project where both sides learn, where you learn, and but also we learn too. We learn through you, and you learn through working for us. And again, that feels like listening as well as talking, and it
Yes.
feels like, again, humans crawled out of the primordial ooze. So progress is made by conversations. And yeah, feel free to reach out, and we can converse.
Super. You heard it here, folks. That was a phenomenal conversation. And not just that, but I think I'm leaving here with a lot more knowledge, a lot more curiosity to find out more, not just about your work, but about how the industry is changing. So thank you, Jonathan, for teaching us and the opportunity to learn from you.
Ah, pleasure. Nice to meet you all. And good luck with the rest of your series.
Cheers. For our listeners, we'll catch you on the next one. Hope you can have a fantastic day. If you love this episode, please do not hesitate to listen to it again. Cheers, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Hey there, folks. We're wrapping up today's episode with a quick one from our sponsors, Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world, directly sourced from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and at the end of our episodes, we like to wind down, and we cannot think of a better way to wind down than with a cup of hot Nepal tea. So if you'd like to check them out, go and look them up at nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com for more information. See you on the next one, guys.